Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, our special series on GE's legacy in Western Massachusetts.
GE made billions in the transformer business. And we're saying, you know what, instead of packing the station wagon, which they've done, it's kind of like, you owe it to us to come back to Berkshire County and clean this stuff up.
Also today, the state pay equity bill.
Anything we can do to make sure that Massachusetts continues to be a place where no matter who you are, you believe you're getting a fair shot is a good thing. But the devil oftentimes is in the details on this stuff.
Details such as, how do you define comparable work when trying to close the gender pay gap? And the insatiable hunger of gypsy moths.
The whole horizon is brown. That's because it's mostly oak trees and they've eaten them all.
That's all next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's continue today with our special series on General Electric's legacy in Western Massachusetts. GE operated massive transformer manufacturing plants in Pittsfield for more than 80 years, and yesterday we heard from former plant employees and the surprising combination of deep love and frustration they feel for the company. Today, we're going to explore how GE's legacy carries forward in the region, specifically how Western Massachusetts is dealing with the major chemical contamination GE operations left in the waterways. People have very strong feelings about this. For example, here's Tim Gray, executive director of the Housatonic River Initiative.
GE made billions in the transformer business. And we're saying, you know what, you owe it to us. Instead of packing the station wagon, which they've done, it's kind of like, you owe it to us to come back to Berkshire County and clean this stuff up.
Polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, were banned by the government in 1979, but they were widely used in manufacturing for decades prior to that. As we discovered, this is probably the only fact about GE's legacy where there's universal agreement. On just about every other aspect of what to do with the contamination, there's a variety of deeply held opinions and disputes. For example, GE estimates that there could be up to 70,000 pounds of PCBs left in the Housatonic River today. The EPA puts the number at some 600,000 pounds. Back in 1998, GE and federal, multi-state, and local governments reached a consent decree that laid the groundwork for cleanup plans. A couple of years later, the EPA and GE rehabilitated a two-mile stretch of the Housatonic in downtown Pittsfield. Now, the focus is on the rest of the river, as it's called, a more than 10-mile stretch of the Housatonic, and there is a great deal of disagreement on how to clean it. We'll start with the group stuck in the middle, the Environmental Protection Agency.
We've heard, you know, GE saying, well, you know, you're taking too much out, you're going to hurt the river. Other people saying, you're not taking enough out, you're going to hurt the river and all the critters. So, you know, we're someplace in the middle, and we're hearing criticism from both sides, but that's not a surprise. And, you know.
Jim Murphy is the EPA's head of community involvement for the Housatonic. We're with him and Dean Taliaferro at Uncomet Brook, which flows directly into the Housatonic River. Taliaferro has been the EPA's project manager for the Housatonic cleanup for 15 years. So what exactly are we seeing
right
then?
Now you're seeing a dried out brook.
Just a dried out brook.
Right. Typically this would be filled with water or a flowing brook. And when the restoration's done, there'll be more clean soil put back in.
The Uncomet Brook cleanup is typical of these kinds of restorations. The water's diverted, contaminated soil is dredged out, and clean soil is put back in. Pretty straightforward, in theory. That is what was done in Central Pittsfield. GE says it spent more than $500 million on that part of the project, but the company objects to the EPA's new plans for the rest of the Housatonic River. Earlier, at the EPA's field offices, Jim Murphy described those plans to us.
Our proposal is to have the waste whatever comes out of the river and the floodplain, we're estimating it's close to 1 million cubic yards, be shipped out of state.
And therein lies the problem for GE. It would take about 100,000 dump trucks to move all that contaminated sediment out of Massachusetts in compliance with state regulations. The EPA estimates it would cost $300 million just to do that, bringing the total cost of restoration to more than $600 million. GE objects to the size and scope of the EPA's plan, and in a January 2016 letter to the EPA, GE argued that it should be exempt from state hazardous waste regulations. It called the EPA's plan, quote, arbitrary and capricious. In a March letter, GE wrote that, quote, EPA also concedes that out-of-state disposal of contaminated sediments has no other benefit than placating local opponents. The EPA still has to make a final decision, and the dispute could ultimately end up in federal court. However, back in April, GE CEO Jeffrey Immelt told WBUR he's optimistic.
Oh, gosh, look, we're just completing maybe the largest dredging project in the history of mankind on the Hudson River. So my suspicion is that we'll be able to come up with a good solution with the state of Massachusetts. We're very knowledgeable about how this should be done.
Immelt's referring to the 50-year, $1 billion PCB decontamination of the Hudson River. So back at the Uncomet Brook site, I asked the EPA's Jim Murphy about what Immelt said, specifically that GE knows how PCB cleanups should be done.
Right. Well, the Hudson and the Housatonic are two very different rivers, and I'll just leave it at that.
Did I touch a nerve there on accident?
Well, no.
That's what he said, right?
Right. Well, they did the work on the Hudson according to the EPA plan, so that's all we're asking them to do again. We have a lot of experience, too, and we think we're the experts.
So part of this story is, yes, a battle between experts. We left the Uncomet Brook site to meet with another expert at a part of the Housatonic River that could be dredged under the EPA's plan.
Head southwest on Merrill Road toward Larch Street.
My name is Rob Brooks. I'm a professor of geography and ecology at the Pennsylvania State University. And I've been visiting this area for research for nearly 40 years.
We walk through wetlands and along the banks of the Housatonic. Brooks points out migratory birds, threatened amphibians, evidence of beavers in the area. And he says all of this could be destroyed by the EPA's plan.
It would be devastating. And this whole section is proposed to have 1 to 2 feet of the river bottom completely removed. That means they have to basically turn it into a construction site, put up a wall, a waterproof wall, work on one side, do the work there, then go to the other side. So imagine that kind of construction going on here. So every place you see right here would be gone.
But could the Housatonic recover from the cleanup? 25, 50, 100 years from now, could the river return to its current state of wilderness, I ask him. Because that's part of the calculus here, isn't it? Short-term disruption in exchange for a river that's clean and healthy in the long run. Robert Brooks shakes his head.
Our own experience with rivers that have been restored and monitoring those is that they don't come back to this kind of condition.
And that's why he's opposed to the EPA plan of a wholesale cleanup of the Housatonic. In fact, Brooks advised GE on an alternate plan, targeted surgical cleanups where PCB contamination is highest.
Then when I see EPA's remediation plan, it's like a giant sledgehammer that's just going to pound the system, and it's going to pound it for a long, long time. And that hurts.
Robert Brooks has been coming to the Housatonic for 40 years, and he's done extensive research on the river. But we should note that some of that research was funded by GE. In fact, in the process of reporting this story, we asked GE several times if we could speak with a member of its corporate leadership team. They instead connected us with Professor Brooks and brought him up from Pennsylvania to meet us. A GE public relations manager accompanied Brooks as we talked.
Just one last question. You mentioned earlier that you had done some work with some other researchers for GE, and we are actually here with a representative of GE's PR department. Are you a paid consultant for GE?
Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm an expert, like an expert witness or expert to give independent assessment, and even back to the original Kingfisher studies we did in the early 2000s. You know, I'm here to give my scientific opinion, and they in no way influence that.
We turn to walk back to the cars, but before we depart, Robert Brooks adds one more thought.
I think it's a very small risk to give up what you have and the pleasure of having this in your backyard. It's a real treasure for the community of Pittsfield and surrounding places, and I wouldn't want to let it go. I'd fight hard to save it.
That's exactly what many people who live along the river say they're doing. They're fighting for the Housatonic, but they've got very different views on what saving it actually means.
Yeah, don't destroy the river to clean it. It's all these people that have gotten bought in by GE to say that same bottom line is leave the river alone.
On one end of the spectrum are people like Tim Gray, head of the Housatonic River Initiative. He wants the most comprehensive cleanup possible. On the other end, residents like Jeffrey Cook.
The EPA seems to think can somehow be saved while they rip all this stuff up. But those of us who look at it every day and enjoy recreating in that area have no such confidence that they will do it.
Cook is a member of a group of business leaders that provided input for the original 1998 consent decree. He also lives along the same stretch of the Housatonic we visited.
I'm not carrying a bucket for GE at all and wouldn't. There's a very, very legitimate position among the folks living in Ground Zero, is what I call it, and there's a lot more to what EPA passes off as the gospel that people should be looking hard at before we spend $600 million or more dollars destroying the wetlands, the floodplains, and the river in that area of the city of Pittsfield and the town of Lenox.
The Housatonic River flows through Pittsfield and into Lenox, draining into Woods Pond. That's where we made our final stop and met Tim Gray. You heard him a little bit earlier. He's with the Housatonic River Initiative. And when we met Gray, PCBs were already the topic of conversation with a couple of local dog walkers.
You know, does it make sense? Let's dig them out of the river and let's dump them on the side of the river. You know?
It's crazy.
It is crazy. It's just.
We stood on a bridge that overlooks Woods Pond, and on the surface, it's beautiful.
So what we see is October Mountain State Forest. If you hop out in a canoe and go north, you'll feel like you're canoeing through Montana because it's an absolutely wonderful place. Bald eagles fly through here. Osprey, herons, you name it, are in this section of the river, and they're all eating fish, which are highly contaminated. And this pond here is one of the more contaminated ponds in the country.
How contaminated is it?
It's very contaminated.
EPA says concentrations of PCBs found in wildlife at Woods Pond is up to 100 times higher than what's considered a safe level. The pond acts like a catch basin for the PCBs, and more than half of the PCBs go over a dam and continue downstream 140 miles along the river. GE's preferred solution is to dredge the pond and deposit the contaminated sediments in a nearby landfill. The EPA is pushing to truck the soil out of state. Tim Gray opposes GE's plan, but he also takes issue with the EPA. He wants them to dredge even more of the sediments upstream from Woods Pond. But like so many of the people we talked to for this series, Tim Gray has been fighting this battle for decades. And with that long experience comes a certain kind of perspective.
Well, it's better than doing nothing, okay? It is better than doing nothing, but we're still mystified why we have to leave all these PCBs in the river. You know, when we study the river 30 years from now, will we really be clean? We're very worried about that. And so we say to the EPA, have a little more guts and clean it up, you know? But everything's a compromise with corporations.
To us, that's the biggest takeaway from our exploration of GE's legacy in Western Massachusetts. The people who must make the biggest compromises are those who have to live with that legacy. Also, there is a lot of disagreement on how to manage the after effects of GE's 80 years in Pittsfield. But folks do agree on at least two things. Something must be done, and why that something matters.
You know, this is, for me, it's about our grandkids. this thing is so contaminated, I'm going to be long gone before the results of the cleanup 50 years from now is going to really be seen. But the dream is my grandkids could come down and throw a pole in the river and not be afraid of getting a high dose of PCBs.
Our special series on GE's legacy in Western Massachusetts was produced by Jamie Bologna. You can listen back to both parts of the series at our website, radioboston.org. And while you're there, let us know what you think Boston can learn from Pittsfield. We'd love to hear your thoughts. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Okay, a thought exercise now. Say you have two employees, and on paper, seems like they do roughly the same job. One is a man, the other is a woman. And of course, it's my opinion that there shouldn't be a gender-based pay gap between these two, but what if the woman had a decade more experience and she'd done well on the job, and the man was a newly minted college graduate who maybe wasn't really trying to prove himself? Should there be a pay gap then? But again, remember, what if on paper they are doing what's called comparable work? Well, that phrase, comparable work, is one of the sticking points in the current pay equity bill under consideration on Beacon Hill. And the proposal would seek to define comparable work in Massachusetts. It's one of those devil in the details that Governor Charlie Baker talks about. So we want to really understand those details and ask, what is comparable work? How do you define it? Should the State House even be trying to define it? And what impact could it have on Massachusetts workers and employees? And employers, and more broadly, what could a pay equity bill have on the state as a whole? So for more, we're joined now by Victoria Budson. She's executive director of the Women in Public Policy Program at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. She's also chair of the State's Commission on the Status of Women, which advised the bill's sponsors. Victoria Budson, welcome back.
Nice to see you, Meghna.
It's great to have you. And listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you like the idea of a pay equity bill in Massachusetts? And do you think the bill should include things like defining what comparable work is? If you're an employee, how do you think this would change how you work or the compensation you receive? And if you are an employer, let us know what you think about this as well. Happy to hear from both sides on this. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Okay, Victoria, so there's a lot of aspects to this bill, and I just started with this defining comparable work thing because it really caught my attention. I mean, first of all, should a piece of state legislation even be seeking to define comparable work?
Well, we've had a comparable work bill that's been passed for many, many years in the legislature. The Supreme Judicial Court has required the legislature to clarify exactly what it means in the definition. Now, there's 24 states throughout the United States that have already passed the language, which is in our bill. For example, the language talks about substantially similar work in that it requires substantially similar skill, effort, and responsibility, and is performed under similar working conditions. Now, note that this definition is used by a variety of states: California, New York, Tennessee, Minnesota, Kentucky, South Dakota, Kansas, Wyoming, Virginia, Pennsylvania.
So we're not alone. Yeah.
Not alone. And what you'll notice about those states is there are states that one would consider liberal, states one would consider conservative, states which are red, states which are blue. There's a lot of very interesting things in this bill. And the comparable work piece is really a low-hanging fruit, very standard clarification within the law.
Okay, so I do want to get to those other parts of the bill, but I don't want to leave comparable work just yet because it is one of those points which groups around the state who support the concept, absolutely, of gender pay equity, they point to this as one of the sections where they're not so comfortable with the language of the bill. I mean, just recently, Megan Sullivan, who's on the board of directors for the Associated Industries of Massachusetts, and they represent thousands of businesses across the state, she wrote that, quote, "When I decide that a female with fewer years of seniority has skills and abilities greater than a male co-worker, under this law, she would be precluded from advancing that female employee's career and rewarding her outstanding hard work." I mean, so I think Megan Sullivan is saying that she thinks that the language does actually limit employers in terms of compensating people according to the work they're actually doing.
What's terrific about this bill is it writes into the law that Megan Sullivan or any other employer in the state is welcome to pay people differently in the same job when there's differences in seniority, merit, production, sales, geographic location, education, training, travel required, and so on. So this bill literally states that you can pay employees in the same job highly differently as long as you can make a merit-based argument for why.
Okay.
What this bill states clearly is you cannot pay two people in the same job where all attributes are equal, education, training, travel, education, and so forth, just because one is of one gender and one is of another.
Okay, so interesting, because I was looking at some literature from the world of HR, and I was seeing that some people were raising the concern that even sort of assessing positions and pay, just making that assessment is kind of difficult because, you know, statisticians who specialize in pay audits say that most HR systems don't even capture all the information that's really needed to group people into comparable jobs or to say, like, this set of people is doing the same thing, so let's look at if there's any pay discrepancies amongst them.
Comparable work is certainly an important provision. I think the number of issues or times comparable work will come up is incredibly small. So it's something which we can talk about, but there isn't an issue or concern that comparable work requires people to pay an equal salary to people who have different outcomes in the position. Mm. It just isn't the case.
Okay. So let's talk about what has happened in at least another state that I believe signed a similar bill into law. California signed a bill like this into law last year. What difference did it make there? Do we know?
You know, I don't have any data on California. And what I had just shared, this isn't a provision where you see lots of court cases. This is not a highly litigious event or situation. What's really phenomenal about this bill, and you had talked about employers and how they're reacting and relating. One of the things which is great to see is we have a very active business community here in the Boston area, and the Boston Chamber of Commerce, which represents thousands and thousands of businesses and is the leading business organization in Massachusetts and for professional women throughout New England, has signed on in support and written a very powerful letter where they talk about, as the leading business organization for professional women in the Boston region, that the chamber is proud to be a vocal supporter of this pay equity legislation. Nearly 50% of Greater Boston's workforce is made up of women. And they identify that women are still being paid significantly less than their male colleagues.
Mm.
And I think what's really important is when we talk about the wage gap in this bill, to understand what this means. Now, why are we seeing so many organizations and so many companies getting into the business of focusing on pay equity? Here in Massachusetts, we have Mayor Marty Walsh, very focused, Mayor of Boston, with the Women's Workforce Council, encouraging businesses to sign on to what's called the 100% Talent Compact. And you see the largest employers in the state voluntarily stepping up and saying, we want to solve the problems of pay equity. We've got Partners Healthcare, Putnam Investments, Hill Holiday, Staples, State Street, Suffolk Construction.
A lot of businesses, because I think people are coming around to the idea that it's good for business.
Correct.
But let me ask you that that statement that you had from the chamber, the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce, when was that put out?
So this was put out on January 27th.
January, okay. So because I was looking at some coverage of...
And I should note, Mayor Marty Walsh is not the only one. I can already hear, you know, we've got major support from mayors all over the 351 cities and towns, because what we know in Massachusetts, our workforce is our greatest resource.
Yeah.
This is how we grow our economy in Massachusetts. We're predominantly an economy of intellectual workers. We do well when we're able to keep our talent here. Yeah.
But I was looking at some information about the fact that back in October, so before that letter that you just read from, Jim Rooney, head of the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce, kind of conducted an internal survey amongst chamber members. And, you know, at that time, more than half of the chamber members said they supported the bill, but about 35% wanted to propose amendments to make the bill more workable for business. And one of the things that they were concerned about was the comparable work part that we've already discussed, but also other aspects of the bill, such as a requirement to report wage information by gender to the state, not being able to ask about previous salary history to potential employees. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I will. And I'm going to talk about another provision as well, which I think was of tremendous interest to businesses. So one of the things that happens, if you imagine pay discrimination like a snowball rolling downhill, when you have an employee who's underpaid in an early portion of their career, we've got great data from the American Association of University Women and many other research organizations, we know that it's common that women will receive a lower salary for the exact same position with the exact same number of years of experience and so forth in that first position. When an employer can say, Meghna, what were you getting at your last job? And if you were underpaid, then in your next role, your salary is pegged to the underpayment of the last role.
Yeah.
And what happens is professionally, then over time, you get that snowball effect where the pay discrimination builds on itself. This law is great for business because it says you need to know what that job that you're asking someone to do, what it's worth, and how you gauge performance.
Mm. But on the other hand, I mean, some businesses do say that we need to know salary history so that we can see if we can match the needs of the potential hire. Or
what's fabulous about that is they're welcome to make an offer and see if those needs are met. They can ask someone what their salary needs are. You just can't ask and then base the decision on hiring on what they made in their last role.
Yeah. Victoria, stand by just for a second because I want to let people know that we are talking about the pay equity bill, the gender pay equity bill that's under consideration on Beacon Hill and its various aspects of it. And we talked originally about the idea that this bill could define what comparable work is in Massachusetts, and we want to know what your thoughts are on it. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Do you like the idea of a pay equity bill being passed in the state? What about the pushback that some businesses have been giving that Massachusetts already has laws on the books that cover many of the same issues that the pay equity bill seeks to remedy? Do you think that maybe that's a legitimate piece of pushback? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're speaking with Victoria Budson. She is founder and executive director of the Women and Public Policy Program at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Victoria, hang in here for just a second because I want to take a quick call. Tom is calling from Salem. You're on the air, Tom.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. What's your thought?
I just don't think it should be the role of the government to kind of really try to define and try to, you know, push its reach into what a comparable job situation should be. Let me kind of use a scenario. So I've worked in the food industry a lot. So a comparable job, you know, if you're comparing one chef to another chef, but if the restaurants are completely two different restaurants, you know, a chef working at a mid-range restaurant may be making $45,000, $55,000, where a chef at a higher-end restaurant making $60,000, $70,000, $80,000. So, you know, that right there, that's not comparable based on, you know, what kind of job or the demographic and the kind of type of restaurant that it is.
Right. Tom, Tom, I'm just going to jump in here, but thank you so much for your call because I want to give Victoria a chance to respond to that.
Tom, that's a great question. When you're looking at two individuals, and let's say, as your example talked about, a chef in a high-end restaurant and a chef that was in a more average restaurant, if they aren't in a restaurant that's within the same employer, that's within the same company, then that's not an issue, which is covered by the bill. If it is within the same company, you just made the case of how they're in substantially dissimilar situations because one is at a higher end and one is at an average type of sales in terms of the restaurant industry. And it's only if someone is doing the same work in the same type of role in the same organization, same region, and so forth. And one of the things, while we're talking about business, that businesses were so keen on is this bill does something really important. This bill provides an opportunity that any business which has done a wage audit and looked at their compensation practices within the past 3 years and then taken reasonable steps to address any inequities that they find, they receive what we think of as a safe harbor provision. If someone sues or litigates, they have a protective presumptive assumption, which shows that they're trying to solve the problem.
Interesting, because I've seen that some of the other concerns raised by some folks were anytime you codify anything into law, what you're really doing is opening the door for litigation. And this would protect. Are you saying that there's an aspect of protecting businesses against litigation in this bill?
You know, there are. And I'm going to tell you why, because I think in this case, it's really important to not understand what the law is, but what the intent is. And the intent is to give businesses the ability and the tools to look into and analyze this problem without penalizing if people are trying to get it right. It's going to take time. Virtually every business that's large has some amount of gap. And the idea is to say, it's okay if you have a gap. Your job is to go and solve it. And there is tolerance and support for the solving of the problem.
So I've been told by our producers that our phone lines are full. Surprise, surprise, people want to talk about pay equity. So let's get another caller here. Susan is calling from Marlboro. You're on the air, Susan.
Hi. I wanted to make two points about this. One is that employers are not posting the salary ranges for the jobs, so they're making it very hard for people to apply for the right jobs. But the real thing that drives me crazy about this forever is that what someone is paid in a previous job is completely irrelevant to the current job. The current job should have a salary range already established for internal equity inside that company.
Susan, excellent, interesting point. Let's turn that back to Victoria.
You know, Susan's got it just right. Employers should know what the work within their organization is worth, and internal equity is something which anyone in the HR profession is familiar with the terms, and managers are as well, that companies need to know what the jobs are, how they're organized, and then what they're paid. And it's true. You know, businesses agree. That's why the chamber's on board. People agree that in this day and age, you should pay people within a range that's reasonable and respectful for the work being done.
Let's get another caller here. Lemma is calling from Andover. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. And I apologize, I'm driving right now. But my point is that I work as a scientist in Cambridge. And what I see right now, for me as a woman and working mom, it's very difficult to maintain 8 hours every day. And because I have a small child and I have to make sure that he has doctor appointments and everything else which is needed. But at the same time, when it comes to the promotion, usually the men who always sit in the office and they don't really take care of their children, they can do 8 hours, they will be promoted because our leadership looks at them as those people who are always in the office, always doing the job, and those people who, you know, cannot commit to that 8 hours are not going to be promoted.
Let me just take it back for you because I want to hear what Victoria has to say and be safe while you're driving. Thank you so much for calling. Victoria Budson?
Lima, thanks for that call and that comment. Certainly people often talk about how people balance work and other commitments they have in their life, whether that's childcare or elder care or community responsibility. One of the things that this bill does is when one looks at seniority, if one has taken parental leave, the number of months calculated, you cannot take parental leave and subtract it out of the seniority. So some of the issues that you're addressing actually were thought about and placed into this bill with tremendous support from the business community. And in terms of face time in the day-to-day, that does impact salary depending on who your employer is. And certainly there have been progress made on paid leave and the ability to have that type of time off, but it's outside the scope of this bill beyond that piece of seniority.
But let me ask you about that, because I think there are some folks out there, at least in parts of the business community, who would say, Victoria Budson, you're making exactly the right point that maybe instead of putting together a piece of legislation that that focuses on gender and pay equity, we ought to be doing more engagement and outreach and support of these other aspects of the workplace, which may contribute to the pay gaps that we see, like in the case of Lemma, the caller, our efforts are better focused on that.
You know, Meghna, I think you've got a great point in that there's lots of different aspects. It's really a whole mosaic that creates unequal pay in the workplace. In our society, we see, you know, repeated instances of where time that people need to spend with families or other things sometimes comes out with less pay or less promotion at work. Now, the most successful employers, and frankly, the largest employers in the state, have really been innovative in putting a focus on results and identifying flexible work or shared work hours or creating systems where people can telecommute or hot desk or hotel desk or have flexibility of schedule or flexibility of location. what people want, both in Massachusetts and throughout the United States, is to create a system where workers can be at their highest productivity, where their family commitments are met. So when they're at work, they're not just sitting in the chair, but they're physically, mentally, and emotionally present. And to do that means that you employ all the tools at your disposal.
So I'm hearing you say that you want us to do both. Pass this bill and do those other things.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely. That will help us grow our economy and keep it strong here in Massachusetts.
Let's take another call. Matt is calling from Medford. You're on the air, Matt.
Hi, how are you? I have more of a question, really, and that is how this bill impacts the negotiation aspect of salary when you take a new job, because that creates a wide range of salaries both within genders and across gender. And would that mean that the individual no longer can negotiate salary at the onset of a new job?
Interesting question, Matt. Victoria Budson?
Matt, that's a great question. This doesn't change salary negotiation in any way. There certainly are employers, particularly at the lower end of the socioeconomic strata, where one is in an hourly position where the wage is what the wage is and there isn't negotiation. This bill doesn't impact that. At other types of negotiations and salary, the only thing that changes with this bill, Matt, is that an employer can't say to you, what were you earning in your last job? Mm. Now, you could decide that you want to tell the prospective employer, and you certainly have the ability to do that. The prospective employer can also ask you to submit in writing to them that can they have that information, but only after they've made you an offer. You can't be put in the position of having to give that up at the beginning of a negotiation.
You know, Victoria, one thing which this bill doesn't address, and maybe it's by design because it's almost a whole nother kettle of fish, is, you know, we know about the gender pay gap between men and women and sort of the average numbers. It's like, 80 cents to the dollar on average in Massachusetts, right? But what I was going to say is that the gap is even more egregious when you consider women of color.
Absolutely. And men of color.
And so, I mean, I'm not seeing that the bill is specifically addressing that in any way.
It doesn't specifically address those disparities, because what it does is it means that all employees would have to be paid equally. So it doesn't write in all of the different types of gaps. It creates a structure legally so that all of them would have to come back to a single norm. And let me walk through, and I'd like to ask our listeners, literally imagine where you sit down and pay your bills when I'm reading this. I want you to, whether that's at your dining room table, whether that's at your laptop, sitting in front of the TV, but compared to the white male dollar, when you look across the United States, white women are making 78 cents on that dollar. Native American women are making 60 cents on that dollar. Hispanic and Latina women are making 53 cents on that dollar. African-American women, 64 cents on that dollar. Now, we often talk about the wage gap, but it's really gaps.
Gaps, yeah.
And in between each of those, you would find men of color. And what we know here in the United States is we have lots of workers who, you know, you've got a two people within that family who are bringing home a paycheck, and even working full-time, they are not able to afford their housing, their health care, their education, and food and energy.
I want to squeeze one more call here. Paul Haru is representative, I should say Representative Paul Haru is calling from Attleboro. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
I understand you're one of the co-sponsors of the bill. Is it going to pass in the House?
Well, we're hopeful. The bill has dozens of co-sponsors and, you know, it has bipartisan support as well. Right now, I think what they're doing is basically, you know, the bill is in the committee, and they're kind of tweaking it, dotting the I's, crossing the T's, and making sure that it's, you know, going to be a really strong piece of legislation, because no bill that is filed stays in the form it's in when we actually vote on it. So, but when it does come up for a vote, it will pass. There's no doubt about that. It's just, you know, when that's going to happen. That's what we're dealing with right now.
Right. Well, thank you so much for that call, Representative Haru. And we also read today that Speaker DeLeo was quoted in the Boston Globe as saying he definitely wants to get this to a vote before the end of the session. But Victoria Budson, we literally have just some seconds to go. Say it does pass both chambers of the House and Senate on Beacon Hill. What do we know about what the governor, what Charlie Baker thinks about it? Do you think, he's always talked about the devil in the details, as we discussed at the beginning of this conversation.
It will take 107 votes to be veto-proof. We currently have 104 co-sponsors.
Co-sponsors.
Co-sponsors. So I would hope that Charlie Baker would look across the state and want to do everything he can to ensure economic prosperity, and signing this bill would be an action step towards Massachusetts' economic growth and prosperity.
Well, Victoria Budson is founder and executive director of the Women and Public Policy Program at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Great to have you. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Believe it or not, George isn't at home. Please leave a message at the beep.
I don't even know if I can call that voicemail or leaving messages on people's phones. I mean, in the era of text messaging, does anyone leave voicemails anymore? The Boston Globe's innovation columnist Scott Kersner has some thoughts on this, and he joins us now. Good to have you back, Scott.
Nice to be here.
So you kind of have a gripe with voicemail in your column.
Well, I've been feeling guilty about it for a long time because either people are texting me to tell me that my smartphone's voicemail is full and they can't leave a message, or I dial into my own desk phone voicemail and there's like 36 messages to listen to and they're all irrelevant because I haven't listened to them promptly. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to explore, do other people have that issue? And I ran into an entrepreneur, this woman, Zoe Barry, earlier in June, and she said, you know what? I've completely engineered voicemail out of my life. I don't listen to it. I've trained everybody just to use text and email with me.
And why? Why is she doing that?
Well, I think she's, you know, she's emblematic of, you know, time-pressed kind of workaholic business people of 2016 who, I think this is an important point, they don't have secretaries or assistants, many of them. Uh-huh. So they're managing all their communications inflow. And frankly, the time of dialing into voicemail, listening to the rambly messages, hitting delete, trying to fast forward, trying to save, it's really time consuming. And frankly, a really terse text message says, hey, I would love to have coffee tomorrow at 10. Let's do it.
LOLO, smiley face, right?
The emojis, too. If voicemail had emojis, I think it'd be good for another 100 years.
No, there's got to be, I'm feeling a demographic divide here. Like, if you're definitely 40 or under, I virtually everybody I know in that age group is saying, don't call me, just text me.
Yeah, I think there is a demographic divide, particularly if you look at the comments on my column online. It's a lot of Globe readers saying, who are these young whippersnappers who don't have time to listen to a voicemail? And how can you be in business without listening to voicemail? Well, voicemail has only been around since the mid-70s. It's not, you know, we're not talking about the death of handwritten letters, which I would say is maybe, you know, a sadder thing. And I do think it's generational, particularly because younger people are gravitating to LinkedIn messages and Twitter messages and Skype and Slack and all these ways to sort of get a really quick instant response rather than having your question languish in my voicemail box for weeks.
Or months or years for that matter, right? Now, what I loved is that you actually spoke with the inventor of voicemail, Stephen Boies, and what did he have to say about this?
Well,
No one wants to live to
a key mistake, which is I should have looked up his phone number first and called him to see if he has voicemail and to see if he checks voicemail, but I was on a deadline. So actually, I sent him a Facebook message and a LinkedIn message, and he responded to the LinkedIn message, and we got on the phone. And he's about 73 years old now, proud to have invented voicemail when he was at IBM. But kind of like the rest of us, he said, I think I have voicemail at home. No one good ever leaves messages there anymore. And, you know, I like texts, and I occasionally listen to voicemail on my iPhone. That's what he said.
Listen to voicemail on his iPhone. Yeah. Well, speaking of that, I mean, Apple and possibly others are going to be offering, what is it, automated voicemail transcription. Would that be sent to you as a text?
Yeah, and, you know, Google Voice and other services have been doing this
for a while.
You can get an email or text of the voicemails. I think as the transcription gets better, it'll be more useful. But a lot of people I interviewed use it already today. And sometimes, yeah, you do have to decipher proper names or things that the automatic transcription doesn't get exactly right. But, you know, it makes the information much more glanceable. It's not the 2-minute rambly diatribe on your voicemail box.
I have to say, though, part of me, I mean, maybe it's because, you know, I'm a radio person. There is still that certain aspect of information that is passed through the voice.
Do you listen to your voicemails, though, every day?
Oh, my God. I knew you were going to ask me that.
I want to investigate this. Megna hasn't responded to your voicemail.
If my phone says it's from some very essential people that I need to know what's going on in their lives,
yeah,
then I will listen to the voicemail.
Yeah, but work voicemail, probably too many to plow through.
Ethically, I have to answer you accurately. No.
You don't even know how to dial in anymore.
I think my mailbox has been full for like 2 years.
Well, the interesting comment that an entrepreneur who has this company that sells messaging, cloud-based messaging systems, said to me is, yes, people like the quickness of text, but they sort of do miss the tone and facial expressions of in-person. So he's actually seeing a rise in video conferencing and people who want to collaborate and sort of have their coworkers' faces up on the screen and be able to kind of look up and have a face-to-face conversation so you can get that tone of voice and get that nuance that you don't get from a text message.
So video conferencing is a new voicemail. I love it.
It's the future.
Scott Kersner is innovation columnist for the Boston Globe. Scott, it's always great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Well, finally today, if you've stepped out into the wilderness lately, you might have noticed some unusual Swiss cheese-shaped leaves, like someone took a few bites out of them. That's the calling card of the gypsy moth. And this summer, the insect is turning what would ordinarily be thousands of acres of green forest into giant patches of brown defoliated trees. Scientists say it's in part because of the lack of rain this spring, and that's decimated a fungus that normally keeps the moths in check. Ken Gooch is the Forest Health Program Director at the Massachusetts Department of Conservation and Recreation, and he says the gypsy moth has been a long-standing problem for the state.
The gypsy moth was introduced here in the late 1800s to Massachusetts, to Medford, Mass. It was brought in by somebody looking to produce silk with it. And then it wasn't found to be a good candidate to produce silk. So anyways, it escaped from this entomologist that had brought it in over from France. And then from there, it just expanded its range out very quickly. And in the early 1900s, they started to spray for it to try it. You know, they knew it was going to be an issue. They started actually to spray. And I think they used lead arsenate. And then they started, you know, after that, they used DDT. They used all these really harmful chemicals, pesticides, to try to control it.
Well, Radio Boston producer Allison Bruzek took a walk through the Upton State Forest with Gooch to see just how bad the damage is this year.
So I was thinking we could just walk down here. Just, I mean, as soon as you walk down just a little way, you'll see the gypsy moth. The gypsy moth is about an inch to an inch and a half long. It has a hairy body, has a yellow head capsule with hairs coming out opposite its head. It has blue dots and orange-red dots along the top of its body, and that's kind of a distinguishing factor for gypsy moth compared to other caterpillars. It's probably a banner year for gypsy moth. And this is the damage they've done for this year, and now the trees are stripped of their leaves. It's all gypsy moth. And then you see on the ground all the tattered little pieces of tattered leaves. They don't usually want to or normally feed on conifers, but they're feeding on the white pines because they've pretty much consumed all of the oak foliage. The whole horizon is brown. That's because it's mostly oak trees and they've eaten them all. So you can see the transition from where we parked to here, and they're totally defoliated. And we walk a little bit further. I mean, if you look into the woods there, you can see there's now the trees are stripped of their leaves. You know, in my career, this is the most defoliation that I've seen statewide. Right now, we have well over 100,000 acres of defoliation, which is the most we've had since like back in the late 1970s, early 1980s, the most we've mapped for gypsy moth. If we had repeated years of defoliation like this, then we could be looking at a major tree mortality event because the trees can tolerate, you know, 2, possibly 3 years of defoliation and survive. But then once you start getting repeated years of defoliation, they just don't have the energy, and then the trees weaken and can possibly die. Probably last week, if you'd come in here, it would have been even worse because now they're getting ready to pupate. By July 4th, the feeding will all be done. And then pretty much 7 to 10 days after that, maybe a little bit longer, The moths are going to emerge. You're just going to see moths flying everywhere. Just clouds of brown moths, anywhere where there's defoliation, they'll just be. The male moths will be flying and fluttering, and they try to get into your cars, into your houses. And like they're so attracted to me because I used to do pheromone trapping. So they're like all over me. I can't go in the woods because the pheromones must have impregnated my body. It's like Pigpen and Snoopy and all that. All the dirt that follows them, like that's the gypsy moths following me.
That's Ken Gooch, Forest Health Program Director at the Massachusetts Department of Conservation and Recreation, talking about deforestation across the state caused by the gypsy moth. Well, that's it for today. Our show is produced by Imogene Weinstein, Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek. We had help today from Adam Asher. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.